This is author David Helvarg speaking about 50 Ways to Save the Ocean on April 24, 2006. You can find the full speech at forum.wgbh.org. Part 1 of 2.
This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Even if you get bored, stay around for the guilt-free shrimp. It's an opportunity. We're going to show a video. Technology defeated us, but if you're interested, it's just the four-minute version of the book. More incentive to buy the book, but if you'd like to see it, it's on our website at www.bluefront.org. And part of what it talks about on the video is what I say, the blue frontier, which is literally a frontier in the United States in the sense that in 1890, the Census Bureau declared our western frontier closed. And in 1983, Ronald Reagan, in one of the least noted acts of his administration, opened up, declared an exclusive economic zone stretching 200 miles out from our shorelines that, 3.4 million square miles, square nautical miles of territory that is larger, six times the size of Louisiana Purchase. It's 30% larger than the land mass of the United States. And it's a new frontier that's both wild and endangered. And part of a larger frontier that's a single global ocean. We talk about, 2 days ago we call it Earth Day. And I understand, we have our biases. We're air breathers, we're terrestrial, so we call it Earth. We talk about God's green Earth. When anytime you actually go out and look back at it from space, you realize it's an ocean planet, that it's a blue marble, and it's 71% of its surface is ocean, but that even underestimates the reality because 97% of the living space on this planet is salt water. I mean, we terrestrials, we're kind of living in this narrow band about 300 feet between the groundhog burrows and the tops of the trees where the birds are nesting. The oceans contain life from the surface, from, the turtles, the sea turtles that are munching jellyfish and unfortunately sometimes plastic bags thinking they're jellyfish, down to the Mariana Trench, 37,000 feet below the surface, 7 miles down where only two humans have ever been, in the Trieste back in 1960. We've sent hundreds of people into space. We've only had two people down in the depths of the ocean. And yet it's, we talk about the rainforest of the lungs of the planet, but actually 2.5 billion tons of carbon are absorbed by the oceans, by, phytoplankton that are the real lungs that absorb incredible amounts of surplus carbon and give us back 70% of the oxygen we need for survival. I was talking in Minnesota a few years ago, in February, it was even colder than it is tonight. And people, ask, well, what do we care about the ocean? I said, take a deep breath and think about it. It's the source of not only our oxygen, but the driver of climate and weather. The seas evaporate and that water, forms clouds which rain out into our watersheds. Our mountaintops follow streams and rivers down through watersheds into estuaries, across seagrass meadows and coral reefs and beyond barrier islands back into submarine canyons and into the abyssal depths of the ocean where they slowly begin rising up and creating the continuing circulation of vapor that keeps the circle of life on this planet alive and functioning. And yet we know so little about it. As I say, we're committing billions of dollars to space. We're going to look at Mars and some of the moons of Jupiter, looking for what? Looking for water. And yet we're leaving this incredible water planet. I remember in camp when I was 10 and 11, we'd lay out at night and look up at the stars, and I'd be, just pissed off, jealous that I thought I was a generation too early to visit alien worlds. And then when I was 16, my mom and sister and I, we went down to Key West, went snorkeling for the first time, and there are whole alien worlds right beyond our shore. I was just doing an interview in the main aquarium here with Bruce Gellerman from Living on Earth, and he's sort of very professional, and then he just sort of froze in front of the exhibit of sea dragons. These are related to, they're these incredible creatures. They're related to seahorses, but they look like something out of, something a princess should be riding you know, they have feathers and they blend in tropical and temperate kelp forests. As I say, I discovered whole new worlds in coral reefs and kelp forests. And we're literally discovering new worlds. We've mapped about 10% of the oceans with the resolution we've mapped 100% of the moon and Mars. You go out and you discover things constantly. We've probably in the last 25 years discovered more about the ocean than the last 25,000 years, and yet even as we're discovering it, we're destroying it. It's that same situation we had with our last frontier. The British biological stations in the mid-1800s used to send their people out and they'd document the western country. They'd go out with the mountain men. As the mountain men were shooting buffalo, the biologists would document it. It's a similar phenomenon today. I mean, we have this whole other frontier. We don't understand it, as I say, very well. The science is in its infancy, the maritime history and ecology. We're discovering new species every day, and yet the role in of the oceans isn't fully understood in climate models. It's only been in the last several years. We had climate models developed, computer models in the 1980s that have been refined as science has improved on climate change. And yet, until recent years, the computer model suggested heating would be happening quicker on the planet than it's been happening. Only in the last few years we realized that the oceans have been acting as a carbon sponge, absorbing surplus carbon generated by fossil fuels. And that absorption has, among other things, made the ocean slightly more acidic, which will make it harder for shell-forming critters from phytoplankton to clams to corals to capture the calcium carbonate out of the ocean and build their shells, build their homes. So, as I say, we're discovering things and yet we're putting them at risk simultaneously. We have this cascading series of disasters that are happening literally in the blink of an eye. When I was 16 and first went snorkeling in the Florida Keys, it was almost scary. It was so alive with hammerhead sharks and sea turtles and the colors of the corals. There was 90% live coral cover. Today it's 10% live coral cover. The rest is gone. This fall and summer you've seen that big pool of hot water that generated Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and the other damaging last two hurricane seasons also has caused massive coral bleaching in the Caribbean, which was followed this fall by a range of coral diseases. We've lost much of the third of the corals in the Caribbean as a result of what's happened in very recent time, the blink of an eye. As I say, we have these cascading disasters that I've covered, I've been writing about. There's industrial overfishing for the global seafood market, where now anything indigenous to the sea has a market. Things we used to call junk fish, horseshoe crabs, baby eels, skate wings, sea urchins. They all have a market. We've developed the technologies of war, basically a lot of the technologies that were developed in World War II. LORANs and sonar and radar, and more recently satellite surveillance, are now being used to hunt edible species of marine wildlife. And we're catching fish and other species at rates faster than they can reproduce. We're only beginning to understand how they reproduce. We're only beginning to, the theory on fishing used to be if you catch a big fish, the small ones will grow up. Now we realize you take something like grouper, all the small fish are female and they convert. They're transgender. They convert to male when they get large. You take out the large ones, you've got a lot of bachelorettes looking for a date. I've been out on commercial boats where you go shrimping and you pull up 7 pounds of other species for every pound of shrimp you get. So we have, we're taking 80 million tons of living biomass out of the ocean every year, which translates, when I was doing the book, the first version of Blue Frontier was a great excuse. I got to go out on fishing boats and swim with sharks, visit underwater habitats, and go on oil platforms. And I landed on an aircraft carrier, spent a few days, And yeah, spectacular engineering. You know, you're a 4-acre flight deck and you're watching night ops. They're taking off and tail hooking them, and some are bolting, and you know, you've got 18 decks down to the rudder stems, and you're, you know, and yet you realize it's sitting there in the dark with the captain of this 80,000 ton vessel, this warship, and realizing that every year we're taking the equivalent of 900 fully loaded aircraft carriers out of the world's oceans as living biomass. It's unsustainable. And at the same time, we're creating a harder environment for the surviving wildlife to survive in. We've got what we call nutrient runoff, industrial agriculture, factory farms, and urban runoff from storm drains where we move to the edge of the coast. Right now, 13 of America's 20 largest cities are coastal. And by the 1980s, we were seeing that 17 of our 20 fastest growing counties were coastal. There are more than 20 science studies that suggest if you make more than 10% of a watershed impervious, that is, if you cover it with cement, water quality naturally declines. When you concentrate animals, their waste products are concentrated. So you get industrial hog farming and chicken farming on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay. All that surplus nutrient, that nitrogen, phosphorus, runs into the ocean. The UN identifies 140 coastal dead zones around the world, one-third of them around the United States, because we're a chemical-intensive farming society. You go up to Iowa, for every acre of corn, you're using 140 pounds of petroleum-derived synthetic fertilizers and chemicals, and it's too much. And all the surplus follows gravity down the streams into the rivers, ends up in the Mississippi, and come the spring floods, you're growing a second crop of algae in the Gulf of Mexico. Then the copepods come along, little pinhead critters, and they feed on that. And it decays, the microbes feed on the algal waste and suck all the oxygen out of the water. Anything that can't flee dies, the brittle stars, the crabs on the bottom. And this is happening on a global scale. So, you know, the third thing that's happening is, as I said earlier, the coastal sprawl. We're building on the barrier islands and the salt marshes that we need for restoration. These have historically acted as the filters and the nurseries of the sea, and also as the storm barriers. We lost, you know, in Louisiana, we've lost 140 miles of protective coastal wetlands. The bayous have gone away because the Army Corps of Engineers straightened out the Mississippi. They did flood control that turned the natural flow of sediments down the Mississippi would spread out in the bayous and grow new land. Then we built straight lines to access, you know, the Army Corps did it for flood prevention. The oil companies built canals to access their production. At the same time, they're taking out oil from the subsurface. You had subsidence, as a fisherman down in Cocotrees told me. He says, it doesn't matter if it's oceans rising or land subsiding, our feet are still getting wet. And in 2005, a city drowned and a coastline was washed away. When I was writing the first version of Blue Frontier, I talked to Mark Davis. We met in this, I don't know what a surfer bar is doing in New Orleans, but that's where we met. And he's working on Louisiana 2050. He says, you know, that if we take out the straight lines and restore the oxbows and the bends and the rivers, we can regrow land. Even with sea level rise, we could bring back the wetlands of Louisiana. It would cost $14 billion. 2000, I said, well, Mark, do you really think you can sell the U.S. public on spending $14 billion to restore your wetlands when they're mostly, the coast is mostly owned by the oil companies, you got the Army Corps against you, the developers? He said, well, if we can't convince the public and make the argument, the hurricane's going to come along and make a case for us. So I called him right after Katrina. I said, so Mark, he says, yeah, it sure sucks being right, doesn't it? And, you know, so these are the disasters. I mean, industrial overfishing, nutrient pollution that also, you know, it rains out from our tailpipes. All the nitrous oxide that we go when we drive around precipitates down and adds that nutrient over-enrichment. Most people at least are aware we've put CO2 in the atmosphere. Most people don't know we've doubled the global nitrogen cycle in the last 60 years. And on top of that, you add fossil fuel-fired climate change. And this just supercharges hurricanes, it increases erosion, it warms the world's oceans, it's melting glaciers, it's acidifying our oceans, bleaching corals. I've seen bleached corals in Florida and Fiji and Australia, and it's kind of, you know, they're delicate critters, these little polyps. They're living things, and they need, you know, they're massive, but they're sweet little critters, you know, very delicate, and they need seven things to stay healthy. Tropical corals need low nutrient environment. They need clarity. They need a certain acidity, and they need a certain warm temperature range. If it's 82 degrees, they're happy. If it's 84 degrees, well, the way they live is the polyps got little tentacles. They're grabbing passing critters and eating them, but that's about 30% of their nutrients. The other 70% is the algae they kind of farm. It's called zooxanthella algae, and it gives it the brown and purple and green colors of the corals. And when you get that extra 1 or 2 degrees warming, the algae turn toxic, the corals expel them, and then they start slowly starving to death. So we're seeing coral bleaching as a result of warming. We're seeing these whole cascading disasters. And having documented it, you think, well, gee, why don't you, you know, you go on the water, you might not want to come back out, right? You could just drown yourself. And actually, in the end, I'm frustrated but not depressed. The reason I'm not depressed is because, well, there are two reasons. One, the last chapter of my book is called The Seaweed Rebellion. As I went around the country, as I continue to go around the country, I meet all these watermen and women, scientists, people working in places like the New England Aquarium, surfers who went into the ocean and, you know, to get their stoke and came out with ear infections and gastrointestinal disease, and were not happy. And they organized, they formed groups like Surf Rider Foundation, 50,000 eco-surfers who work for clean water quality. You have fishermen I know who understand, and fish providers who understand that what they've been doing for 50 years, if they're going to continue it for another 50, they have to do it in a sustainable manner. We can't catch fish faster than they can reproduce. And we know what the solutions are. We've had two major ocean commissions just in the last few years. There was the independent Pew Oceans Commission, made up of governors, politicians, scientists, environmentalists, fishermen. And then a few years later, in 2000, you had the federally appointed, the Bush administration appointed U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, top heavy with admirals, some people from the oil industry, the shipping industry, academics. Yet they went out, they did a fairly dispassionate series of hearings around the country, and with very different makeups came to very similar conclusions, that the ecological collapse of our oceans is a threat not only to our environment, to our economy, to our national security. They provide over 300 recommendations on how we can reduce nutrient runoff, on how we can do sustainable fishing and harvesting. The heads of those two commissions, Leon Panetta, a Democrat who was chief of staff under Bill Clinton's presidency, and Admiral Jim Watkins, who was Secretary of Energy under the first Bush administration, before that chief of naval operations, they were in Washington. I met them a few weeks ago. They drew a report card for Congress and the White House, how they responded to their commission recommendations. They gave them a D+. And I think they're still grading on a curve. I think there's a failure at the center because policymakers are like sharks. They're hardwired to certain incentives. And those incentives today include money, but they also include votes. And if we can mobilize the public to vote the coasts and the oceans they love, we can have change. If we can educate the public to the fact that it's not, a lot of people look at it and they say, well, you're talking about global collapse of fisheries, you're talking about climate change and fossil fuel, and, you know, how can I possibly impact that in my life? I work, I have a family. The answer, luckily, was provided more than 60 years ago by anthropologist Margaret Mead. She says, don't believe a small group of dedicated people won't change the world. Nothing else ever has. And what we do in our everyday life, it's not even about changing your life to have an impact. Your life has an impact. What we do every day has impacts on the ocean. It's being conscious of what those impacts are and making conscious choices to do the right thing. The first in 50 Ways to Save the Sea, the first recommendation I have is go to the beach. You know, go to the beach, pack out everything you pack in, maybe leave it a little cleaner, bring a litter bag. But basically go there because that's what we do. We have that connection, it's response. It's not just what I was saying, it's not just the recreation, the transportation, and the trade, and the energy and the protein we get out of it. It's not the economic benefits, it's so many of us. 53% of us are now living in the coastal zones, and so many of us feel that spiritual connection. I certainly do. I mean, our bodies are 71% water, like our planet, and our blood's exactly as salty as the sea at the point that we emerged from it. And we all emerge from salt water, you know, on an individual and evolutionary basis. A lot of us have that sense of connection and wanting to give something back, because we go to the beach and it's a first experience for so many of us, for kids who go to a tide pool or go to a beach, and you know, you build a sandcastle and you end up an architect 30 years later. You know, you get caught up in the fascination of the tide pool and you discover science. You just look out at the ocean, or you get held by your parents in the waves, and you realize that there's something larger than you are. And that realization that can be both really scary and really alluring, I think, keeps bringing people back to the shore. And we go back there wanting to give something back. I really, as I travel around and talk to people, I find more and more people who are looking what they can do. And a lot of the things we talk about, responsible boating and, you know, using a cleaner four-stroke engine instead of two-stroke, have diapers or rags for, you know, if there's any oil spillage in your boat, fish responsibly, you know, dive responsibly, take only pictures, leave only bubbles.
This is author David Helvarg speaking about 50 Ways to Save the Ocean on April 24, 2006. You can find the full speech at forum.wgbh.org, part 1 of 2.